Al-Aqsa Mosque, Rubashabet, Gaza.
The U.S. State Department's Bureau of Near Eastern Affairs said the U.S. envoy to Yemen has met with the director of USAID to discuss the need for more donors to provide additional humanitarian funding to address the growing crisis in Marib. Experts believe that this step is an attempt by the U.S. to provide new weapons to its tools in Marib, including terrorist groups who protect its agenda in the oil-rich province.
The continued advancement of the Yemeni army toward liberating Marib prompted the United States to use the humanitarian crisis to supply the terrorist groups in Marib with weapons so that the conflict could not be prolonged. U.S. push for peace has no basis in reality, and continued siege on the Yemeni people is the proof.
Observers said the USAID plays a suspicious role wherever it exists, adding that it uses the humanitarian and relief work as a cover-up for its military and intelligence activities.
The U.S. Agency for International Development is an intelligence agency. It shows a humanitarian aspect, but it hides a lot of illegal activities, including supporting terrorist groups with weapons. The United States will not accept peace unless its conditions are met. Washington is the one who leads the war in Yemen and cannot be a peacemaker.
Last year, the Yemeni army found large quantities of weapons carrying the logo of USAID in Al Bayda and Marib front lines after recapturing areas that were controlled by Daesh and Al-Qaeda.
Yemenis believe that the U.S. is directly involved in the deadly war against their country. They say it is their right to liberate their lands from any foreign existence, as well as terrorist groups who serve the interests of the U.S. and Yemen. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
The U.S. troops are fast withdrawing from Afghanistan under a peace deal American had with the Taliban 2 years ago. On the other hand, the Taliban, the militant group who already control nearly 75% territory, is now sieging and capturing districts and regions around the capital city. The Afghan government blames neighboring Pakistan for supporting Taliban's ongoing rapid territorial gains, an allegation Pakistan denies. With the new law in the bilateral ties between Afghanistan and Pakistan, influential former diplomats, think tanks and politicians from the both sides held a meeting in Islamabad. The objective behind this gathering, better known as Track 2 diplomacy, is to bring down the tension between two countries and help Kabul to find out a peaceful solution. Negotiations between the Taliban and Ashraf Ghani government have resumed in Doha with no progress in sight. The Taliban wants setting up their brand of an Islamic government, while Ashraf Ghani is not willing to accept an interim setup to replace him. The U.S. fears the Taliban could possibly overrun the capital Kabul if President Ashraf Ghani does not strike a peace deal with them.
And the withdrawal obviously will take place, with or without the settlement. God forbid we are sucked back into the 90s and there is anarchy. Civil war. Is that a concern? Yes, it is.
The U.S. has made it clear that Pentagon would not carry out airstrikes from its aircraft carriers outside Afghanistan to prevent Taliban's possible takeover of capital Kabul.
The Americans are tired of this war. They are fatigued and they want to leave as soon as possible. And they don't want to invest more money, more energy, and they don't want to fight in Afghanistan any longer. Taliban are very confident they will be able to establish their upper hand in any future dispensation.
In a recent interview with a German newspaper, Afghan President Ashraf Ghani said he knows his death is just one bullet away. Analysts believe that his remarks shows on how he perceives the threat of Taliban's violent takeover of capital Kabul after the U.S. lost war and left his government onto the mercy of warring Taliban. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
Based on official statistics, systematic targeting of Shia people in Afghanistan kicked off almost 7 years ago. Since then, over 1,000 Shia civilians have been killed and many others wounded, including women and children, in tens of separate attacks, such as bomb blasts or targeted killings.
Our people face a real systematic genocide, and this trend has drawn a very dark future for us. We have been repeatedly targeted by brutal terrorist attacks, mainly in western Kabul. I think gone are those days when people were killed because of their belief or ethnicity.
However, it seems that the time for killing of Shia people has already arrived for the terrorist groups, mainly Daesh.
This comes as the Afghan presidential palace has promised to implement a comprehensive security plan in western Kabul to tackle security threats there. However, there is still no positive change in the security situation in the Shia-dominated area of western Kabul.
In the latest incident on Saturday evening, two minivans were blown up in western Kabul. The twin blasts claimed the lives of at least seven Shia civilians and wounded more than 10 others. In the meantime, some prominent Shia leaders urged the government to either urgently unveil its own security plan for western Kabul or approve people's security plan to protect Shia people against terrorist attacks and bombings.
The government must provide our people with security, otherwise the situation will get more dangerous. This will force peaceful people to pick up guns once again to protect themselves against violence.
Afghan government blames Taliban for targeting Shia population. Taliban, however, reject the accusation. This comes as Daesh proudly claims responsibility for most of such attacks and even warn of launching more and more attacks on Shia people across the country. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
On the sidelines of the NATO summit in Brussels, Democrats Abroad Belgium held a rally to coincide with the visit of Joe Biden. We sought their views on current efforts to save the JCPOA Iran nuclear deal, which Biden's predecessor, Donald Trump, tried to destroy.
I would actually encourage Biden to make that leap of faith and go ahead and say, listen, we're in, the sanctions are lifted, now it's up to you.
I don't know any more about the outcome than you do, but I'm confident that they're sincere about trying.
I'm crossing my fingers. He's allowed to do at least half of what he's trying to do because there's a lot of obstruction in the Senate, of course.
Inside the summit, calls were made for the 30 countries in NATO to stand strongly together in order to face down current threats.
Especially at a time when authoritarian regimes like Russia and China challenge the rules-based international order.
Moscow and Beijing reject the criticism, and some analysts argue NATO is merely trying to justify its existence by creating adversaries. Also, there are divisions within NATO itself. For example, Turkey and Germany have important economic ties to Russia and China. Even the UK seems to be trying to tone down NATO HQ rhetoric.
I don't think anybody around the table today wants to descend into a new Cold War with China. I don't think that's where people are, but I think people see, they see challenges.
For his part, Joe Biden had this to say about Vladimir Putin ahead of a meeting with the Russian president on Wednesday.
He's bright, he's tough, and I have found that he is as they say, when he used to play ball, a worthy adversary.
There have not been huge protests to coincide with Biden's visit to Belgium. That's in stark contrast to when Donald Trump was here. Clearly, the optics are different on this occasion, but critics of U.S. foreign policy say fundamentally the same problems still exist. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
After more than a decade, Israel has turned the page of Benjamin Netanyahu rule, ushering in a new era with a new coalition cabinet led by Naftali Bennett, the head of the right-wing Yamina party, and Yair Lapid, the leader of Yesh Atid party. However, the Palestinian leadership remains skeptical, saying it expects no changes in Israeli policy towards Palestinians. It says the only difference that could be seen is that former Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu will no longer be there. Palestinian officials say they expect the Bennett-Lapid cabinet to be worse than the one it's replacing.
Israel's policies won't change even if a new coalition is taking office. There is no hope for change from the Bennett rule. In my opinion, it's more extreme than the one it's replacing. Bennett is likely to pursue the same right-wing agenda as Netanyahu. And here comes the role of the international community to prevent future aggression and violence against the Palestinians.
Bennett, a former chairman of the Yisha Settlers Council, has long vowed to prevent the establishment of an independent Palestinian state, and he supports the annexation of major parts of the occupied West Bank, as well as expanding settlement construction. Experts say Bennett doesn't believe in a solution to the Palestinian-Israeli conflict and will continue to act this way even if he's not an opposition leader anymore, or at least supposed to be. Israel's new cabinet held a festive first meeting Sunday night following a historic Knesset vote, with 60 members voting in favor, 59 against and 1 abstaining. Bennett urged his ministers to show restraint over the numerous ideological differences between parties in alliance to ensure its stability. Bennett will serve as prime minister first as part of a rotation agreement with Lapid. He will serve alternately as prime minister and foreign minister until the handover of power to Lapid on 27th of August 2023. Experts warn that in an attempt to prolong the life of the new fragile eight-party coalition, Naftali Bennett, the new Israeli prime minister, will exert every possible effort to appease the most extreme elements, especially through the continuation of settlement activities across the occupied territories. Mona Kandil, Occupied Ramallah.
Ngo Dinh Diem, a pro-American, became president of South Vietnam in 1955 and, with the assistance of the U.S., began to arrest anyone suspected of being a member of the Viet Minh Communist Coalition. The U.S. then gradually increased its troop deployment to the country, fearing that communism would soon spread across the region. In 1964, the Gulf of Tonkin incident gave the U.S. government an excuse to justify a war on Vietnam. An intruding U.S. destroyer clashed with North Vietnamese Navy torpedo boats in August of that year. In an ensuing sea battle, one U.S. aircraft and three North Vietnamese torpedo boats were damaged. Also, four North Vietnamese soldiers were killed. As a result, the U.S. Congress then approved the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution, which authorized U.S. military action in the region. After a bloody and protracted war, a truce was struck in 1973, ending direct U.S. involvement and completing the evacuation of American forces, which had grown to 500,000. The war claimed the lives of 58,000 Americans and 4 million Vietnamese. It impacted 700,000 American veterans, cost the U.S. more than $100 billion, and tarnished the country's image and morale at home. However, the true narrative behind the Vietnam War was revealed after then-Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara commissioned a secret history based on classified papers, the Pentagon Papers, in 1967. He formed a research team to assemble and analyze Defense Department decision-making dating back to 1945. An analyst on the research, Daniel Ellsberg, eventually disclosed portions of the report to the New York Times, which was published in 1971. The papers revealed that the U.S. had secretly enlarged the scope of its actions in the Vietnam War, with coastal raids on North Vietnam and Marine Corps attacks, none of which were reported in the mainstream media. The Pentagon Papers are an important record of the United States' first defeat in a war. To this day, the United States' failures in the Vietnam War, as well as its atrocities in terms of civilian casualties and the deployment of chemical weapons, have stained America's reputation at home and abroad.
Ashes and rubbles. There is nothing more left as despair has once again taken over Rohingya refugees in New Delhi. A devastating fire has brought down the entire camp to ruins. Around 55 families were residing in the camp. Most of the refugees have escaped unharmed, but all they had has turned into ashes. Now some local NGOs and residents are lending support.
It was around 11:30 in the night yesterday when my children started crying due to the heat of the fire. When I opened my eyes, there was huge smoke and fire. We immediately got out of our shanty and moved to the safety.
The residents of the camp are not sure how the fire started, but an eyewitness said it started in the middle of the camp, and within an hour, everything was on ground, and it took the firefighters a lot of efforts to control it. Rights activists have urged the UN Refugee Agency for prompt response in helping them with every possible way.
I don't know why we are facing all this hardship. Our lives are miserable. We can't live in our own country with dignity. And wherever we go for refuge, hardship follows us. I'm happy to have my child alive. I can't forget the scene I saw yesterday. Even if I close my eyes, it frightens me.
The camp is surrounded by a cluster of shanties where people from all faiths live. Many people I spoke with had a suspicion that either the fire broke out due to a short circuit or it could possibly be a conspiracy to vacate them from the location, since the deportation campaign to expel Rohingya from India has gained momentum in recent years. The blaze has destroyed everything these people have had. Now they have to brave both the harsh heat of the summer and the fear of the COVID-19 pandemic. Their miseries continue to mount with each passing day. In a display of mercy and compassion, scores of neighboring residents and activists from the NGOs reached the spot to lend whatever help they could. Estimates suggest some 40,000 Rohingya refugees are living in India, who are now stuck in limbo amid a vicious campaign to deport them. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
Almost 59 million Iranians are eligible to vote in the upcoming 13th presidential elections in Iran. Speaking at a press conference on Monday, head of Iran's election headquarters, Jamal Orf, said out of the more than 59 million eligible voters, there are almost 1,400,000 first-time voters in this round of the elections.
There are almost 59 million eligible voters for the 13th presidential elections, out of which almost 1,400,000 are first-time voters. For the presidential race, we have arranged over 67,000 ballot boxes across the country and 450 more worldwide.
Seven candidates are running in Iran's 13th presidential election due on June 18th. All of them have so far been focusing on the economy, battered by sanctions and mismanagement in recent years.
The number of polling stations and voting hours will increase for people to participate in the June 18 presidential elections, to observe health protocols and social distancing rules. Over 5,000 personnel in charge of the election have received the first dose of their COVID-19 vaccines. All agents in polling stations must have a certificate of negative test so as not to spread the virus.
Although some of the contenders have a stronger professional backgrounds, one cannot really tell who holds a better chance to win the top executive post before all candidates lay out their plans. Under the election law, the presidential campaigns of the candidates will come to an end 24 hours before the polls open on June 18th. According to the election headquarters, in more than 100 countries worldwide, there are over 200 polling stations already arranged for the June 18th presidential race. Salman Kujuri, Tehran.
Mohammed Al-Attar, a Palestinian teacher, has lost his wife and three children in an Israeli airstrike in his house in North Gaza Strip. Mohammed's four-story building that was a shelter for his entire family totally collapsed to the ground. Mohammed, who used to have a normal life, working at a school and looking after his kids, is now homeless and without a family.
Israeli airstrikes hit our building without any prior notice. I just opened my eyes and found all of us under the rubble. Some of us managed to get out of the rubble. I tried to save my children, but to no avail. I called for help from Civil Defense Service, but it took long till they reached us. I just want to ask the international community and human rights groups, what are our rights? I had a peaceful life and suddenly I became homeless without a family. I lost every hope I used to have.
Hassan al-Attar, Mohammed's father-in-law, has his own sufferings to tell. Working in the civil defense services, he was surprised with a call informing that his daughter, along with her three kids, were killed by Israeli airstrikes. Staring at the bodies of his daughter and her three children, Hassan bid farewell to his daughter while he was at work trying to pull their bodies from the rubbles.
I was at work when Mohammed called me to tell that Israel bombed his house and my daughter and her three kids were under the rubbles. They weren't ambulances. They were all out on missions and I had to wait for one. When I got to them, their bodies were all out of the rubbles. I don't know why Israel targeted them.
Most Gazans are in need of mental health support following the latest 11-day escalation that killed families in their homes in Gaza. The north parts of the Gaza Strip, along with Beit Hanun and Jabalia, was one of the areas that witnessed bombardment coupled with heavy artillery shelling. Hundreds of Palestinians, including women and children, were killed in the Israeli bombardment of the Gaza Strip in 11 days of the conflict that began on May 10. Israel's airstrikes also brought widespread devastation to the already impoverished territory. Palestinians here say the aggression has not undermined their will to stand against the occupation regime. They say despite their suffering, they will remain steadfast and fight for their rights. Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life.
Axel Jawadi talks about the various keys of life and has brought about this book to be a companion for the very famous Mafatih al-Jinan, where one is a tool or the keys for paradise, and this book, of course, are the keys of life.
The Keys of Life, a program designed to tell you that what Islam gives you will help get you home with joy and faithfulness. So, well, listen to
The Keys of Life.
The world is a very, very big house. Many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up. We must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. My name is Sheikh Zaid Al-Salami. A few years ago, I started the course of wanting to commentate on a very important book that I believe is something that would be useful for everyone who reads it, and that is the book Mafatih al-Hayat, written by Ayatollah al-Uzma al-Sheikh Jawadi Amuli. So we were talking about believers and how do we deal with fellow mu'mineen, mu'minat. We do understand that we have to try to strengthen that network of brotherhood, sisterhoods. There's so many things that we need to work on in our communities. I understand that there's also that issue of tension that might exist between the fellow believers. They're of your same rank, they're of your same party, they're of your same faith. The mu'mineen, the mu'minat, those who, you know, have embodied Islam in their practical life. You know, we need to strengthen one another and we need to be there for one another. We need to have that level of love and compassion towards one another, so much so that when we see each other, you know, we have that level of comfort and we know that they are there to support us, to back us. If we slip, if we make a mistake, if we err away from the path, they are there to bring us back. They are there, you know, to elevate us. They are there to cover up for us. You know, this is what a mu'min does. If we are trying to seek ways of covering up or seek ways of having benefit of the doubt and husn al-dhan and avoiding su' al-dhan or anything else, this is something that we need to do. Now, what's the case when you are dealing with a Muslim who is not that much into practicing, or who is a sinning Muslim, someone who sins, or someone who is probably even corrupt, and they openly, you know, commit haram. You know, I think the best example that we can use, which would be the worst case for a fellow Muslim, is someone who doesn't pray. You know, and that is really on the edge of iman and kufr. You know, a person who is tariku salah. You know, although we treat them as a fellow Muslim and everything else, you know, but if you read the hadith that is mentioned from Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam, you know, tariku salah in the akhirah, you know, they won't be resurrected as a Muslim. And there are many of these kind of ahadith, which is why, you know, a Muslim can do, probably commit variety of sins, but when it comes to these foundational matters, then, you know, it's also going to be very, very difficult for them on Judgment Day, which is exactly why there's such an emphasis on iqamatu salah. Yes, we understand that along with your salah, you need to make sure that you observe that which encompasses and embodies that devotional side of your connection with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Imam Sadiq alayhi salam says that you don't test someone by how much or evaluate someone by how much they pray or how much they fast. It could have become a ada for them, could have become a habit for them. You know, they were born into it, they grew up doing it, and it became a habit for them. You test them in two things, sidqul hadith wa ada'ul amana, how truthful they are in what it is that they say, and number two, that they return back the amana, they preserve, they honor, they respect that which has been entrusted to them.
Ayatollah Javadi Amoli, the author of the book Mafatihul Hayat, The Keys of Life. This book, Mafatih, ought to be in two volumes. One volume, the present volume, Mafatihul Janan, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc. But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree. Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam, who has stressed out the reward for praying, has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree. There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment. When growing wheat, take some in your hand and say these prayers. These are what the very Imam has mentioned. We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
Amana has a variety of applications. It's not just someone giving you an amount of money and you returning that back. No, amana is amana. It could be verbal amana. It could be physical amana. It could be mental amana. You know, I'm giving you something. For example, I give you this book and I want you to take care of it. You know, please take care of it. It's mine. Take care of it. You look through it and you say, wow, these are some nice things that this person has written. I'm going to copy from it and write it in my own name. That's khiyanatul amana. That's you betraying amana. Someone entrusts something to you as a secret. Or so in a private gathering, they say something. And of course, if they wanted it to be publicized, they would have said it in the public. But they don't. You know. And as we know, al-majalis bil-amana, as the hadith says, widely spread hadith, something that is so frequently mentioned. And so you test someone by sidqul hadith wa ada'ul amana. Now, How about if someone, you know, doesn't do any of these things or is not counted among the mu'mineen, but among the, what we say, fasiqeen, among the sinful, among those who are, of course, morally corrupt, spiritually corrupt, religiously corrupt. Of course, what I want to do as a Muslim, I want to protect myself, I want to safeguard myself, I want to make sure that I am not influenced in the bad way by anyone who is around me. You know, this is my right, you know, this is my obligation. You know, I don't want in any way to be dragged down by the wrongdoings of somebody else. So I need to classify and categorize those people who are around me. Walhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen, wa salatu wa salamu ala Sayyidina Muhammad wa alihi tahirin.
Driving past, walking fast, to the field of dreams, hear the children's screams.
There was The Keys of Life by Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Every corner represents a different image in my mind. A momentary emotion, space spent in time. Memories fade like a dusty windowpane. And you can't see your past no more. The only thing that remains is that feeling of warmth in your heart that will always be there, be there.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The limelight.
The FBI is pursuing potentially hundreds more suspects in the Capitol riot, the agency's director told Congress on Tuesday, 15th of June, calling the effort to find those responsible for the deadly assault one of the most far-reaching and extensive investigations in the Bureau's history. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Luke Broadwater. The piece is titled, FBI is Pursuing Hundreds in Capitol Riot Inquiry, Ray Tells Congress. FBI is pursuing potentially hundreds more suspects in the Capitol riot, the agency's director told Congress on Tuesday, 15th of June, calling the effort to find those responsible for the deadly assault on Congress one of the most far-reaching and extensive investigations in the Bureau's history. We've already arrested close to 500, and we have hundreds of investigations that are still ongoing beyond those 500. Christopher A. Wray, FBI's Director General, told the House Oversight Committee. Christopher Wray's assurances of how seriously the agency was taking the attack by a pro-Trump mob came as lawmakers pressed him and military commanders on why they did not do more to prevent the siege, despite threats from extremists to commit violence. The threats, I would say, were everywhere, said Representative Carolyn Maloney, a New York Democrat who's the chairwoman of the House Oversight Committee. The system was blinking red. Representative Caroline Maloney confronted FBI Director Christopher Wray with messages from the social media site Parler, which she said referred to threats of violence to the FBI more than 50 times before the attack on 6th of January. One message, which Ms. Maloney said Parler had sent to an FBI liaison officer on 2nd of January, was from a poster who warned, "Don't be surprised if we take the Capitol building, and Trump needs us to cause chaos to enact the Insurrection Act." "I do not recall hearing about this particular email," Christopher Wray replied. "I'm not aware of Parler ever trying to contact my office." In hearings before two congressional committees on Tuesday, 15th of June, lawmakers sought new information about the security failures that helped lead to the violence. At one hearing, Caroline Maloney presented her committee's research into the delayed response of the National Guard, which showed that the Capitol Police and Washington officials made 12 urgent requests for their support, and that Army leaders told the National Guard to stand by 5 times as the violence escalated. "That response took far too long," Carolyn Maloney said. "This is a shocking failure." Documents obtained by the committee showed that beginning at 1:30 p.m. on Wednesday, 6th of January, top officials at the Defense Department, the Pentagon, received pleas for help from the Capitol Police Chief, Mayor Muriel Bowser, of Washington, and other officials. But the National Guard did not arrive until 5:20 p.m., more than 4 hours later, after the Capitol perimeter had been breached. The National Guard was literally waiting, all ready to go, and they didn't receive the green light for a critical time period, hours on end, said Representative Rohana, a Democrat of California and a member of the House Oversight Committee. Lawmakers had tough questions for General Charles Flynn, who commands the U.S. Army Pacific, and Lieutenant General Walter E. Piatt, the director of the Army staff, both of whom were involved in a key phone call with police leaders during the riot, in which Army officials worried aloud about the optics of sending in the National Guard. According to those involved, it was the first time lawmakers had heard from either general. In their testimony, they described a frantic call in which the chief of the Capitol Police and the Metropolitan Police became agitated as they tried unsuccessfully to get military support whilst rioters attacked their officers at the Capitol building. "Both speakers on the phone sounded highly agitated and even panicked," General Flynn recalled. By contrast, he said, General Piatt was a calm and combat-experienced leader. General Piatt has defended his caution in initially advising against sending in the National Guard, telling the committee that he was definitely concerned in the days before 6th of January about the public perception of using soldiers to secure the election process in any manner that could be viewed as political. He told the committee that the National Guard forces were not trained, prepared, or equipped to conduct this type of law enforcement operation. "When people's lives are on the line, 2 minutes is too long," General Piatt said. "But we were not positioned for that urgent request. We had to re-prepare so we would send them in prepared for this new mission. General Flynn is the brother of Michael Flynn, President Donald Trump's disgraced former national security advisor, who has emerged as one of the former president's biggest promoters of the lie of a stolen election. In submitted testimony, General Flynn said he had not participated in the call, but merely overheard portions of it when he entered the room whilst it was in progress. He said that he had not heard any discussion of political considerations with regards to sending in the National Guard. I did not use the word optics, nor did I hear the word used during the call on 6th of January 2021, he said. The panel did not hear testimony from the acting chief of the Capitol Police, Yogananda Pittman, who declined to attend, citing her need to hear testimony at the other hearing before the House Administration Committee. Republicans were quick to criticize her decision and repeatedly referred to her absence during the session, which stretched into the evening. Representative Caroline Maloney said she was also disappointed, but she added that Police Chief Pittman had committed to testifying on 21st of July. In a simultaneous session on Tuesday afternoon, the House Administration Committee heard testimony from Michael Bolton, the Capitol Police Inspector General, and Greta Goodwin, the Director of Homeland Security and Justice for the Government Accountability Office. Michael Bolton testified about his fourth investigative report into the failures of 6th of January, which found that the department's tactical unit did not have access to adequate training facilities or adequate policies in place for securing ballistic helmets and vests. 24 were stolen during the riot. The agency's first responder unit was also not equipped with adequate, less lethal weapons, among other findings. Michael Bolton's reports found that the Capitol Police had clearer warnings about the riot than were previously known, including the potential for violence in which Congress itself is the target. He also revealed that police officers were instructed by their leaders not to use their most aggressive tactics to hold off the mob, in part because they feared that they lacked the training to handle the equipment needed to do so. About 140 police officers were injured during the attack on 6th of January, and 7 people died in connection with the siege, including one police officer who had multiple strokes after sparring with rioters.
Back to reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Roundtable from Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so very much for joining us on today's episode of Back to Reality. In the studio with me, I have two special guests and friends. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, sister.
Alaykum salam wa rahmatullahi. I am Sister Nasreen, and I'm happy to be here.
Thank you so very much, Sister Nasreen. Although your accent makes it quite obvious, just for, you know, our listeners to get more in tune with the vibe of our discussion, can I ask where you're from and what you've your studies have been?
I'm born in England, and I am studying Masters in Philosophy of Ethics.
MashaAllah. Thank you so
Applied
very
ethics,
much.
Actually.
Thank you so much for that information. And my other lovely guest is...
Assalamu alaikum, dear sister. I'm Muzaffar Haider from the UK. I'm studying here in the holy city of Qom, studying Islam, and I'm at your service today.
Awesomeness, a joy and a pleasure. You guys, thank you so very much for joining me on today's discussion. Today we're going to be talking about something that, you know, because of certain ahadith, I feel like Muslims shy away from addressing it, from chasing it, from inspiring toward it. Like a hadith that's, especially from Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salam, where he says, beware of tul al-amal, like far-fetched dreams. Or a hadith from Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, where his eminence says, I fear for two things for my ummah after me, one of which is tul al-amal, again, far-fetched dreams. And today we want to talk about dreams of Muslims. Like, as a Muslim person, what kind of dreams and goals do we have? And whether the word dream is even appropriate to be used in this context.
Jazakallah for that. Yeah, no, you did a really good job, because you introduced one of the main ideas here, which is fundamental to this discussion, which is this idea of having, you know, طول العمل, and people would translate it as having like fake dreams, you know, these hollow, shallow dreams. I'm going to become this, I'm going to do this in the future. Actually, perhaps a more appropriate translation would be far-fetched hopes. That's what they're really talking about, right? Far-fetched hopes. One day I'll become a good Muslim. One day I'll do this, right? It's a complete fantasy. Complete fantasy. Why do I say that?
Why do you say that?
Because the present is all that exists, sister.
True.
This is all we have, right? The past is history. The future is a mystery. Today is a gift.
That's
why they call it a present.
Did you just quote Kung Fu Panda on this extremely serious show?
But there's a wisdom behind it, right? And that's the reality. Now, dreams are a different thing now. To have dreams, and we're not talking about the types of dreams that you have when you're sleeping, you know, nightmares, and you dream about, I don't know, my brother had a dream that a carrot was chasing him, and he woke up in cold sweats. You know, we're not talking about those kinds of dreams. We're talking about having a dream. You know, having a dream that the world could be a better place.
Oh, you remind me of someone.
The Martin Luther Jr.
Exactly.
I have a dream.
All right, thank you so much. Sister Nasreen, what is your opinion on this matter of Muslims having dreams? Or how do you define?
I agree.
Really?
I agree with him. No, I mean, this is basically, if someone is a practicing Muslim and goes back to the core values of Islam, then our dream is something within, like my dream is that my child becomes a living example for the living imam. You know, the dreams should center around something of reality, and that you work towards those day by day. But we should never sort of have something in the future that is not connected to our behavior today. And it should be a transformational type of, you know, it's dangerous to use the wrong word, ambition,
definitely.
I suppose. You see, Islam is something that goes back always to development of the self, and eventually goes to the physique, but we won't go into that. But the way that we tend to see things is because is the way that we have been influenced by the secular thinking, which is something outside the self.
For sure.
You know, like a big house. Okay.
This sort of detracts
us from what our actual mission in life, our creation, is for. You know, what we've been created for.
All right, just to...
So I agree.
All right. In conclusion, we agree. We agree with the fact that طول الأمل, not cool, having far-fetched dreams and hopes, because all we have is now, the present time, the today. And there's a hadith from Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salam that says exactly that. Don't grieve about your yesterday. It's already gone. Don't worry about tomorrow. It may never come. All you have is today. Right? And then the next point is that to define dreams and goals and ambitions in an Islamic context, we'd say something that a development process that happens inside me rather than something that's actualized
outside of me, mm-hmm. like a house or a status mm-hmm. or money or zeros in my bank account. But I feel that since we are material beings, unfortunately, I wish we weren't, because, you know, now things
are... There would be no challenge.
Everything
an angel,
is just
then.
So complicated now. Mm-hmm. We still have, as Muslims, things that we want to see happen in the outside world that makes us feel fulfilled and successful and achieved.
Explain that, please.
Okay.
Let me hold in. Explain why you think that an outside thing can fulfill an inside.
Oh, because, no, in a emphasis on a Muslim person. A Muslim person, I'm thinking about a person who already has Islamic values and Islamic criteria and Islamic standards in their lives. Their ambition is toward gaining things that will help them become a better Muslim, right? And naturally, because they have that material aspect of them going on, there are material things that would act as a means to help achieve that goal, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. If I have a certain degree of money, I don't actually always have to be grappling with crippling poverty. Mm-hmm. If I have a certain degree of money where I can live an exceptionally good life and help others as well, if I can reach a certain academic degree to empower my Islamic society, my Islamic brothers and sisters.
Islamic academic degree is an inward dream, not an outward.
Don't you think it's both, though?
No.
I think it's both, yeah.
It's an established, you're getting a sort of certificate or recognition that you have achieved an inward.
Yeah, but it manifests outward anyways. It's not like okay. So many other inward things. So, Brother Muzaffar, how would you say, with that said, mm-hmm. what sort of dreams and goals do you think as a Muslim you have, or you think other Muslims have had, or we should be, you know, we should be ambitious toward?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So let's just categorize it very quickly. There's two types of dreams, basically, right?
Thank you, yeah.
One for the dunya, one for the akhirah. All right. Mm, so dunyawi dreams, you know, I want a big house, I want to be rich, I want to be famous, I want this and that and this and that. They're all materialistic things. They'll never make you happy at the end of the day. Even if a person has a mountain of gold, he'll want another mountain of gold to add to it. That it'll never ever satisfy you. This dunya is like seawater, according to our hadith. The more you drink, the thirstier you'll get. Eventually, you will die.
Very nice.
It sounds bleak.
No, it's a very,
and you're like, eventually you will die.
Potent.
You will die. That's it. All right. Well done. You got your dunya, and there you are. You're an old man, and you're dead. There's a really interesting story, actually. There was this guy, really, really, like, basic guy. He lived in the village, and like away from technology and stuff, completely separated from modern society. And a capitalist comes to him. And he goes, he sees this guy, and he's in his boat, and he's catching a fish in the scenic kind of, you know, village, and there's like a lake there. It's all beautiful. He's catching a fish. The capitalist says to him, "Why are you doing this?" He goes, "So that I can feed my family." Mm. He goes, "Well, why don't you sell the fish instead?" The guy goes, "Why? Because then if you sell the fish, you could tomorrow, you know, buy two boats and employ somebody to go and catch fish with you." And then he goes, "Why?" And then he goes, "So that then you can get a company established in your name eventually, and then that company will churn out fish and sell it internationally." He goes, "Why?" "Because eventually you can retire." And then he goes, "Why would I want to retire?" And he goes, "So that you can relax and catch fish." He goes, "Right."
Exactly.
And it brings us right back to this discussion of living in the here and now. Now, these are dunyawi dreams. There are real, true dreams that we can have, that we can aspire to, which will help our akhirah. What is a man? Since I'm sitting here with two sisters, what is a human except one who tries to make the world a better place, mm-hmm. right?
The whole idea of making the world a better place entails a lot of investing into the future.
Of course. You need to... See, Islam... It's incredible how much of Islam focuses our attention on عَمِلُ الصَّالِحَاتِ, doing good deeds. الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا وَعَمِلُ الصَّالِحَاتِ. It continuously repeats
that
this.
That is the investment.
It's about believing and doing action. The action part is often missing. You believe that you can accomplish certain things, but then you don't set out to do them.
And the Quran will actually help us to get connected to accomplishing those great dreams. Now, one verse that I'd like to highlight here is one of my favorite verses. In tansurullaha yansurkum. If you help Allah, He will help you. Now, you have to believe in that. If your dream is to do something which Allah wants to have accomplished on the earth, you will have His help in doing it. And another verse is, when you've made your decision, trust in Allah. Right? You have
that's
to
very,
make
that's
your
a
decision.
Very important
you know?
Point, yes.
Believe in that decision now and just trust in Allah. He will help you get there.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And you know, I think I wanted to, although it deserves some input, but just because of the time, I'll go on to add what I was wanted to add, that, you know, something practical for people that, you know, they're maybe confused about this situation and when to sort of focus on a dream versus focusing on an action or behavior. You know, like, for example, when you're selecting a spouse, there's this expectation aspect that is the killer. You know, when you go into a marriage for expectations rather than how can I perform if I am to choose this spouse? Am I able to perform my duties with this kind of spouse? And how can I contribute? How can I, you know, bring my talents and my personality into it? As opposed to, what am I expecting to gain out of this union? And I think if we can distinguish in our minds or in our heart, how are we making sort of decisions? How are we making our dreams? Is it a selfish dream or is it a communal dream that will end in the goal that every Shia today should have and is created for in this time, is for the reappearance of our Imam. That is our ultimate and should be our only focus and dream today. How can this selection process that we're going through, that we had in our last program, help me towards this goal?
I'm so glad the conversation came to this, because I feel that basically sums up every dream and goal and ambition a Muslim Shia especially could have. It's the definition of making the world a better place. It is the epitome of becoming a better person. It is the person. It is the actualization, planning for the future, right? It brings everything together. This whole concept of preparing the world and creating the groundwork for the reappearance of Al-Hujjah alayhi salam brings everything together. Thank you so very much, you guys, for your opinions and your input. And thank you to our listeners for being with us on this episode of Back to Reality. Until another greeting and salam, I leave you in the care and protection of the Almighty. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alameen, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again.
Ya Allah,
Ya Rabb al-Alameen, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again, let us see daylight again. Once again.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.